This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. This is AJ Woodhams with the War Books Podcast, where I interview today's best authors writing about war-related topics. Today, I'm here with Steve Kemper, the author of Our Man in Tokyo, an American ambassador, and the countdown to Pearl Harbor. Steve, how are you today?
I'm fine. Thanks.
Wonderful. Well, I got to say, I loved your book, and a lot of other people must too, because I had to go to several different libraries in my county to get this book. They were all checked out. When I went to actually get this one copy, it was, you know, when you walk into a library and there's like the featured books section right up by the front desk, it was right there. And I felt like I had to like beat other people to it. So I scooped it up. I read it and I loved it. And I'm so excited to talk to you about it. First, can you just tell us your background and what got you interested in this topic?
Well, I've been a freelance journalist for about 40 years, and the last 10 years or so of that, I've been writing books of narrative history. Before, I was a journalist covering living people, and the last 10 years, I've been focused on the dead. But the same principle sort of applies: research, bringing them alive, you know, suspense, tension, conflict. Except that I can't re-interview them. I have to find other sources to confirm what they say or not. So that's my background. I've written four books. Three of them are these natural narrative history books, and the first one was an immersion journalism book. So that's my background, and it's worked out fine.
Yeah, and I've got the list of books that you've written that's on the back cover of your book. It's A Splendid Savage, The Restless Life of Frederick Russell Burnham, A Labyrinth of Kingdoms, 10,000 Miles Through Islamic Africa, Codename Ginger, The Story Behind Segway, and Dean Common's Quest to Invent a New World. These seem like all completely different topics. What makes you find these topics? And then, I guess, with, you know, going into your book with Japan, how did you find Japan for this book?
Well, as a freelancer, I was always a generalist, not a specialist. That meant I had to find things that were off the beaten track. And that's what interested me the most anyway. Find something that's people are not aware of, and then make them excited about it. And that's essentially what my journalistic career was about. And that's what these books are about. These are the first two historical books were obscure historical figures they should have been better known. Let's put it that way. One was a great explorer of Africa in the 1850s, and the other was a sort of soldier of fortune from America in the late 19th century, early 20th century. And then, of course, I have the subject of my current book, Joseph Grew, who was very well known during his tenure in Japan. He spent 10 years in Japan as ambassador in the 10 years before Pearl Harbor. He was there when the bombs dropped on Pearl Harbor. So he was very well known at the time. He was in the newspapers all the time. He got recognized on the street when he came home for furloughs, but he's been forgotten. And I thought that was a shame. And I wanted to tell the story of this lead up through the perspective of Gru. And I was able to do that because he left 6,000 pages of a diary that he kept in Tokyo. There were thousands of dispatches to and from the State Department, his personal letters, his speeches, scrapbooks that he kept, clipping books that he kept for each year that he was in Japan, coverage of everything happening. So it was a treasure trove for me, and I hope I was able to bring him and the situation alive to make the past breathe for the reader and to feel the same stresses and tensions that Gru felt.
Oh, that's really great. Well, I think you did. Like I said, it was a great read. So your interest really then is, so you came across his diary and you were like, wow, this is a fascinating guy.
No, what happened is, to give credit, I read a book called In the Garden of Beasts by Eric Larson, which is it's a great book about the American ambassador to Berlin in the early 1930s as Nazism was just starting to poke its ugly head into German politics. And I finished that book, and it was so fascinating to read about this culture going insane that I thought, who was our man in Tokyo? And that's what led me to Joseph Gru.
Oh, well, and aptly named the book, Our Man in Tokyo.
Yeah, never changed. It's a peculiar.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Well, let's dive into the book. So the book starts in, I believe, in 1932. It's almost 10 years leading up to Pearl Harbor. Can you just give the audience some context? What was going on in the world at this time? And then what was going on in Japanese society at this time?
Well, what led to Gru's appointment in 1932 was the invasion by the Japanese army of Manchuria in 1931. And the Japanese army did that without seeking permission from the civilian government in Tokyo. So Hoover saw this and thought, this is alarming. We have what seems to be a rogue aggressive force starting to operate in Asia, and we need our best diplomat to go there because it's the most stressful place in the world right now. And our best diplomat was Joseph Gru, so that's why he got appointed. As the 1930s wore on, Germany became equally, if not more, alarming. But in 32, it was Japan, and so that's why Gru went there. Now, Japan at the time, and I was surprised by a lot of the things that I found in my research. I, like a lot of Americans, I tend to know more about the rise of Nazism and Germany than I do about what was happening in Japan in the 1930s. My knowledge about Japan essentially starts with Pearl Harbor. And what I found was chaos, violence, coup attempts, paranoia. It was a seething mass of frantic imperialist ambition. And so very rich material, but this is what Gru stepped into, and he was supposed to sort things out and try to bring Japan back into the fold of the Western nations.
Yeah. And similar to you, I also, one of the reasons why I really like this book is my knowledge of World War II is also mostly European, you know, what was going on in that part of the world. And I knew very little and the lead up to the bombing of Pearl Harbor. And I too was shocked at the chaos. I went to the Wikipedia page for prime ministers in Japan, because in your book, I kept reading all these different names. Every other chapter, there was a new prime minister, it felt like. And there were like 15 from the 1930s leading up to the end of World War II, which is incredible. But yeah, like you said, it really came off to me as a time that was tumultuous, that assassinations, the book starts off with the assassination of a prime minister, I believe. Mm. And it really just a chaotic scene that I had no idea about. Well, paint a picture then of Joseph Gru, of Ambassador Gru, U.S. ambassador to Japan at this time. Like you said, he was very recognizable, or he was very well known, and even he would get recognized on the street, which I guess in the world of diplomacy is something that's very, not every diplomat gets that kind of fame. Tell us about Joseph Gru. What was he like? What was his background? And what were some of the things that made him special during this very kind of chaotic, tumultuous time?
He was born in Boston to Boston Brahmins. He had a wealthy, privileged upbringing. He went to Groton and then to Harvard, like his father and his brothers had. And when he got out of Harvard, he was expected to go into Boston business or banking, as the family tradition decreed. But instead, he told his dad, "That idea bores me to death. I can't do it." And his father was appalled and said, well, you can have a year to have a kind of a wingding abroad. But when you come back and you get this out of your system, you'll go into the proper place. Well, he went to the Far East. He didn't take the usual tourist leisurely trip. He went to the Far East. He climbed mountains. He hunted big game. He got malaria. What all this did was intensify his desire for adventure and for living in foreign places. And so he came home and told his father, it's going to be the State Department, not State Street. His father was appalled, but eventually accepted it. And Grew ended up in what was not a professional service at that time. It was a privileged class of people who were appointed by, it was patronage, all patronage jobs. So Grew had to find a patron. He eventually did and went to his first post in Mexico City. He served in 14 posts. He helped usher in the professionalization of the Foreign Service. And for that reason, he's known as one of the fathers of the Foreign Service. Although we didn't get rid of patronage jobs, which he deplored for the rest of his life, because we know where that goes. And he worked his way up through various ambassadorships until finally he was appointed in Japan. And that's what happened. He left behind a life of privilege and leisure, comparatively, for a life of adventure and serving his country in foreign places. He was devoted to that idea.
Yeah, I was also surprised at, although, you know, to be an ambassador is obviously, you know, that's a very prestigious thing. But I was surprised that back at this point in time in American history, early 1900s, that these were patronage jobs. And, you know, it was very kind of elitist group of people who were the ambassadors. So I also found that surprising. Tell me a little bit about Joseph Grew's personality. I loved you had a quote later on in the book about Grew, whereas a pessimist finds difficulty in opportunity, an optimist finds opportunity in difficulty. I hope that's your quote, because that was very profound. And you were speaking about Ambassador Grew's attitude towards how he was going to work with the Japanese. So I definitely got the sense here and throughout the book that this guy's an optimist. He's working hard to prevent war, and he's a positive person, maybe. But tell us a little bit about the man and his personality.
Well, that was a quote from Grew, by the way.
Okay.
And he was describing himself. So,
oh, great. Yes, Even better.
He was an optimist by nature. And that often got mistaken, I'm afraid, for being soft. He wasn't soft. He wanted to find, as he thought an ambassador always should, opportunities to improve relations. So that's why he went up all the way through the 30s into the early 1940s, when Hull, Secretary of State Hull, was just convinced that the Japanese could never do anything that would be trustworthy or a movement towards peace. Grew kept finding opportunities to wedge diplomacy back into what was going on. That didn't mean he was naive or soft. It just meant that he was, in his view, a good diplomat, because you never give up. You never give up on the idea of peace. That's his main job as an ambassador. So he was certainly an optimist. He was diplomatic, even in his diary. There's no scurrilous anecdotes in his diary. There's nothing. There's occasionally some irritation. A couple of times there's anger, but never anything, never anything juicy, I guess you could say. Because he thought that his diary would be useful to historians in the future, and he didn't want to go outside the diplomatic channels that he had created for himself. So I consider him, and he was also, by the way, devoted to the idea that an ambassador should be empathetic to the country where he's posted, that you have to go in there trying to understand their point of view, their needs, their motivations, because if you don't, then you're not going to be able to make any headway. You have to understand what they're going through and thinking. And secondly, if you don't come in with that attitude, they won't trust you. so that they will not open up with what they really want. They won't trust you when you say that I might be able to get that for you. So he was really an ideal diplomat, in my view.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely got that sense throughout the book, not just with his interactions in Japan with other Japanese diplomats and other diplomats from around the world, but even somebody from, you know, he's got this privileged background. He's from Harvard. Even somebody with that kind of background, I loved the anecdote where he's with Babe Ruth, and Babe Ruth's like drinking a Boilermaker. He's having a shot and a beer, and Ambassador Gru is living it up with him. You know, I love that kind of dynamism that was in his personality, which probably made him such, you know, an effective diplomat. Is you just kind of get the sense that people liked him. People enjoyed being around him.
You're absolutely right. People liked him. Even though anti-Americanism grew and became very poisonous during the 1930s, it was very rarely ever directed at Gru, because the Japanese understood he was trying to understand them. So he somehow escaped that, you know, because he tried to be a diplomat. And he was also gregarious. He was charming. He was handsome. He liked people. He talks about his social calendar. And he says at one point that, thank goodness, it has sort of gone down a little bit. And then he lists about 20 different social occasions that he had that month, because that was a light schedule for him. So he liked being with people. He liked to get to know them. He thought that was an important thing for an ambassador to do. And people liked him in return.
Yeah. Well, you talk about when Ambassador Gru first went to Japan. He had to learn a lot about Japanese culture. And I also found myself learning a lot from your book about Japanese culture. What were some of the things that an ambassador in the 1930s going to Japan, what are some of the things that an ambassador would have to learn about Japanese society?
Well, that's a big one. The first thing, of course, for an ambassador, the main thing is, where are the levers of power and influence? Who do I approach if I want to influence policy, change policy, have any effect? And in Japan, it was really hard to find those levers of power because there were so many of them. You had the Diet, which was the parliament. Japan was a parliamentary democracy at that point. So you had the elected Diet, upper house, lower house. You had the cabinet, which was very important and powerful. You had the palace, because Japan had what they considered a divine ruler, Emperor Hirohito, who was supposedly the commander-in-chief and the head of state, yet he had almost no power, because since he was divine, he wasn't allowed to make any decisions, because if he starts, you know, when you start making decisions, you're going to start making mistakes. Well, gods can't make mistakes, so the way to cut out the mistakes is to give him no chance to make any decisions, which is an odd thing. And yet the emperor's desires, wishes, as communicated through his palace officials and other advisors, carried weight. And then, of course, you had the military, which became hugely important and influential during the 1930s, and their right-wing codependents, a lot of patriotic societies, they were called, who wanted to influence the government towards the militaristic stance that became more and more prominent in the 1930s. So Gru's trying to figure all this out. There was no Führer. There was no Il Duce. There was many different tunnels and a maze, and Gru had to figure out contacts, who to talk to, who to believe, and that's what he tried to do.
Talk a little bit more about the emperor, because I actually knew also very little about Japanese society and their reverence towards the emperor. Maybe talk a little bit about the idea of the emperor in Japan, but also I'm kind of curious about Emperor Hirohito as a person too. What were his views, if we know, what were his views on the West, on as we approached war? You know, was he a hawk? Was he a nationalist? Was he a very right-wing kind of person? Talk a little bit about the emperor.
He's a very controversial figure, And most people are familiar with him from the war. And during the war, he was faithful to his country. He became more hawkish. He supported the military because that's what you do if you're a patriot and your country is at war. Before that, though, in the 1930s, it seems very clear to me that he tended to have Western sympathies. He ate an English breakfast almost every morning of his life because he was an Anglophile. He liked the United States. He wanted better relations with the United States. He sometimes instructed his new prime minister that you will appoint a foreign minister who wants better relations with the West, not someone who wants to undermine them. So he showed signs, to me at least, in the 1930s of alarm at the way his country was going. And yet he eventually got sucked into the plans of the militarists. So he's a complicated guy. He was a weak man, I think. He was a scientist. He liked to spend his free time studying marine organisms in his lab because he wasn't allowed to make any decisions. So he looked for things to do. He very rarely left the palace grounds because if you're a god, you don't do that much. Most Japanese never heard his voice until his surrender speech in 1945. Grun knew him. He went to dinners there. He met him many times, of course. And his impression of him was that he was an odd man with some tics. He had certain tics. He had a very high voice. And yet he was considered a direct descendant of the first emperor who was sent down by the sun goddess 2,600 years earlier. So, and from that first emperor were descended the entire Nippon race, the entire Japanese race. So everyone in Japan had a little bit of divinity in them because they were all descended from this first divine emperor. And the story said 2,600 years, but the story was first fomented about a century before. So
yeah, I remember reading that.
it gives you some sense of how odd the culture is. And Gru understood that the Japanese would do anything that their emperor asked them to do. People in D.C. thought that economic sanctions would work, the oil embargo might work, that all these different things that we tried might bring Japan to its knees. And Gru kept telling them, no, you don't understand the Japanese. They will fight until they are using sticks against our bombs. No one will surrender until the emperor says it's time to surrender.
Yeah, and I've heard stories of, even after the war ended, going all the way up to like the 1970s, where Japanese soldiers were still, doing as they were instructed to do. They weren't surrendering. They were still hanging out, guarding whatever hill that they were told during the war to guard 20 years after the war ended. And it's a really fascinating culture with, it's so strange as Americans, of course, we don't have an emperor, and to have that kind of reverence was something that I found very interesting to learn about in your book. Talk to me a little bit. So we've got the emperor here on one hand, and you mentioned this earlier, you've got the military, on the other hand. Tell us a little bit about the military situation in Japan in the 1930s. What walk us through kind of the progression from 1932 to the end of the decade with what was going on with the military.
The military right wingers, which tended to be hot-headed young officers, saw Japan's divine destiny to rule Asia. And so they were always looking for ways to expand Japan's territory. They started with Manchuria. They moved down into the five northern provinces of China, eventually fomented a conflict there. Then eventually they started the Sino-Japanese War, a devastating war that most Americans don't know about, that claimed millions of lives and sucked Japan dry financially and economically. The military started demanding and got 50% of Japan's budget to to finance these plans. The Japanese people suffered because of this. They couldn't get polished white rice. It all went to the military. They couldn't get clothing, textiles. They couldn't get metal products. They couldn't get food, fish, fresh meat, fresh anything. Most of it went to the military. The Japanese were told to sacrifice because this was what the emperor wanted. It was for the emperor, and therefore you must comply. And they did. So they got more and more greedy. They went, the Sino-Japanese War started, and then they went into northern Indochina. Once the war started in Europe, they went into northern Indochina. Then they went into southern Indochina. And we were each step of the way, the United States and other Western powers were telling them, you need to stop. Don't do this again. Here's what's going to happen if you do it again. And then they would. And then there would be some consequence. And the Japanese would go, why did you do that? What did we do? We're the victims here. Why are you doing this to us? We're the poor Japanese. It was an absurd wheel of frustration for Gru and for people trying to deal with this.
And what were some of so Ambassador Gru, expert diplomat, and it seemed like crisis after crisis that he was dealing with. But tell us a little bit about how he managed that situation and some of these crises that he had to deal with.
Well, let's move right on up to 1937. There was an actual coup attempt by the right wing within the military. They assassinated the Lord Keeper of the Privy Seal, the emperor's main political advisor in the palace. They assassinated a couple of military officers that they thought were impeding the movement into Greater Asia. They assassinated a bunch of people in February 1937. And so Gru, there was not much to do about that. He was hopeful that that would create revulsion against the military and maybe lead to something better for diplomacy. It did not. But the military finally woke up and they put these rebels against the wall and shot them. And so the Japanese public said, oh, good, now the crisis is over. Well, it just made the army stronger because it made the people trust in them even more. Then in 1939, when the Sino-Japanese War began, there was a huge crisis in December as the Japanese approached Nanjing, the capital of the Chinese Republic. Chiang Kai-shek's forces were driven out. The Japanese took Nanjing. And while they were doing so, there was a U.S. gunboat, the USS Panay, which was on the Yangtze to protect U.S. interest along the Yangtze River. To back up a little bit, there was something called the open door policy in China at that time. It was several European powers plus China plus Japan had agreed that China would be an independent country, but would be open to commercial development by all of these nations who had signed the open door policy. So that's why we had a gunboat on the Yangtze to protect American interest. Well, that boat went about 30 miles up the Yangtze to get away from the Japanese invasion of Nanjing. Nevertheless, Japanese Navy planes bombed the Panay and sank it, despite there being stars and stripes on the flagpole, painted on the sides, draped across the decks, massive flags. And then army boats came up to the Panay and machine gunned and went on board looking for survivors. Meanwhile, the Navy planes were also strafing the people who had jumped off the Panay, attempting to find refuge in the weeds. So several Americans died, 30 were wounded, something like that. And Gru started packing his bags. He thought this was going to be a declaration of war. But he also was working his diplomacy. And eventually, with Hull and Gru and the foreign minister of Japan, who was appalled that once again the Army and the Navy had gone off the leash, they worked it out. And so war was averted. And, you know, I can go on. I mean, there's just things like that constantly. When you mentioned how many prime ministers there were, well, Gru dealt with 17 foreign ministers in 10 years, 17. The cabinets kept falling. Gru would, towards the end of the 30s, early 40s, when a new foreign minister would come in, Gru would hand him a portfolio of offenses against U.S. citizens and U.S. properties in China. And By 1940, that list had over 300 incidents on it. I had no idea about that, that the Japanese were that provocative and continued to be. Always said, oh, we're so sorry, we'll investigate it, and if it's our fault, we'll pay recompense. They always investigated. They always found there was absolutely no responsibility on the part of the Japanese, that there was some reason that was the other people's fault. And so that's what Gru was dealing with too. He was constantly trying to say, you need to stop this. If you don't understand that the United States eventually is going to get tired of this, and you're going to suffer when that happens.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Now, what was, talk a little bit about, this is another thing I found very fascinating, because on one hand, Ambassador Gru, he's like you said, working diplomacy with the Japanese and all these different players, these different cabinets, navigating the military situation. Then on the other hand, back in the U.S., he's coming up against a lot of obstacles with the State Department, and specifically with the Secretary of State, Cordell Hull. Talk a little bit about the relationship between Ambassador Gru and Secretary Hull, and just the larger kind of tension between him and the State Department.
Well, Hull came in with Roosevelt as his Secretary of State, and he was a patient man. He was thoughtful and very highly principled, and Gru appreciated his high principles until they became impediments to any sort of negotiation with Japan. Gru was very flexible. He was a very practical-minded political player, whereas Hull tended to insist upon principles. And that was fine until it didn't work anymore. So as the 30s wore on, Gru became a little frustrated with Hull and with his chief advisor on the Far East, a man named Stanley Hornbeck, who thought that the Japanese could not be trusted because they kept breaking every promise that they made and refusing to comply with any definitions of the way to do war. Japan sort of initiated this bombing of civilians, which became common on both sides during World War II. But Japan started that in China. So Gru was, as I said, I'm backing up a little. He was frustrated. He would propose possible avenues for diplomacy. Hull would say, "Okay, go ahead and try it," and then he wouldn't respond to what Gru had found out or what Gru had discovered. So the worst example of this, the most frustrating for Gru, was this proposal in the late summer, early fall of 1941 by the Prime Minister of Japan, Prince Konoye Fumimaro, to meet secretly with Roosevelt in U.S. territory to try to come to some agreements to prevent war, which seemed to be on the horizon. Gru was very excited by this idea, of course, because it had never been, no Prime Minister of Japan had ever left Japan, and the way Japan had been acting, there was nothing like this had come from them at all. So Gru wanted this to happen, and Secretary Hull smothered it. He proposed so many preconditions, all based upon high ideals, that would require Japan to do X, Y, and Z before we would even consider a meeting. And Gru kept saying, "Don't impose the conditions. Meet first and see what they have to say. If it's nonsense, we can return to what we were doing before." And Hull thought that would be a loss of prestige. He didn't think that Konoye would be able to keep any promises that he made, because for good reason, he didn't trust the Japanese to keep any promises. So that possibility died in the crib, and Prince Konoye resigned. General Tojo took over, and a couple months later, we had Pearl Harbor.
Now, was Secretary Hull, did he have a tense relationship with most ambassadors? Or from your research, was the tension specific to Ambassador Gru?
No, and I wouldn't even call it tension. Gru respect, they respected each other. It's just that Gru, he was frustrated by some of Hull's decisions. And, and the other thing to mention here is that Hull and Roosevelt had what the Americans had broken the Japanese diplomatic code in an operation called Magic. So Hull and Roosevelt were reading all the diplomatic traffic between Tokyo and Washington, Tokyo and Berlin, Tokyo and everywhere, so that we knew exactly what Japan's strategy was diplomatically. We knew what they were proposing and what they were really planning. And Gru did not know that because Hull felt it was too dangerous to inform him of it in case Japan had broken our codes or was intercepting our diplomatic pouches. So it was much too valuable a resource to endanger by telling Gru. So Hull had the information that Gru didn't have. Gru had information that Hull didn't have. And of course, you're going to believe the information you have more than what you're being told by, as Gru called himself, the man on the spot.
Yeah, and several times you talk about how Ambassador Gru felt very out of the loop from the State Department. He would often learn about events from either the other diplomats he was talking to or some other channel rather than from the State Department itself. And I ask about the tension between Secretary Hull and Ambassador Gru and other ambassadors because you write in the book about how Secretary Hull did not come from this privileged class that a lot of the ambassadors came from. He wasn't an Ivy League graduate, and he didn't, as far as I understood, he didn't kind of hang around in these more elite circles. And I wondered when I was reading how much that colored the relationship between him and the diplomatic corps, or maybe it didn't.
It's a good question, I'm sure that it did. Gru was, he did what he could to overcome his class biases as a Boston Brahmin. He really did try to overcome them, and of course he wasn't successful. None of us ever are, of overcoming all of our biases. But he didn't ever mention anything in his diary or his dispatches like, you're a hick, or you just trust me, I'm smarter than you. There was never even a whiff of that in anything that I read. So I think the tension was mostly about how to approach Japan. And Hull did not have, not only did he not have a background in an Ivy League background, he didn't have a background in diplomacy. He was an expert on trade, international trade, which was perhaps not the best training for somebody coming into the volatile 1930s. But on the other hand, I got to hand it to Hull. He was very patient with the Japanese. He resisted the hawks in FDR's cabinet, who wanted to several times go to war with Japan, and he fought them off. He kept negotiating with Japan right to the end. He kept trying to figure out a way to stop this. That was partly because he didn't want war, partly because he thought the United States public would not accept a war because we were very isolationist at that point. And third, because he didn't think the U.S. military was ready for a war yet. And we weren't. Our army was in bad shape. Our Navy had finally started to come back into shape because of FDR's pushing that. So there were many reasons why.
What were some of the reasons that Roosevelt's cabinet were pushing for war?
Well, the things I've mentioned, Japan was bombing U.S. territory. Japan was bombing civilians. Japan was taking territory despite clear warnings. Don't do that, or there will be consequences. So Hull was one of the cooler heads in that cabinet.
Would you say the appetite for, if you want to call it appetite, would you say the appetite for war was stronger when it comes to Japan? Or stronger in joining the European conflict?
I don't think I feel competent enough to answer that. I think those two totalitarian governments operating at the same time whittled away at the U.S. sense of isolation. Americans were appalled by the bombing of London, and of course by the takeover of Europe. But the way the Nazis were treating the Jews, the way the Nazis were treating bombing the British, and then you had the same thing on the other side. I think more Americans were interested in a war on Britain's side than they were interested in a war against Japan. It's a natural thing. There were more people with backgrounds that came from Europe. They were closer to us in many ways than Japan was. And so I think the sense was, if we're going to enter a war, let's do it for Britain, not for against Japan, for Asia.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Japan and Germany and their relationship. So throughout your book, you get the feeling that, I mean, there are within Japanese politics, there are people who admire Hitler and admire Germany in the early 1930s. And that really, you really get a sense that really grows throughout the decade. Tell us a little bit about the relationship between Japan and Germany. And then ultimately why Japan decided to ally itself with Germany.
Well, that was another surprising thing to me. I thought that Germany and Japan were joined at the hip from the start, and they were not. They had a very peculiar relationship throughout the 30s and early 40s. As you said, there were many in the Japanese military who were enamored of the totalitarian model and Hitler's territorial ambitions. That's exactly what they wanted for Japan. But there were also politicians, prime ministers in particular, and even ministers of the Navy up through much of the 1930s who did not want to join Germany because they thought that Germany would pull them into a European war. Japan had its own agenda, which was Asian. So they resisted Nazi and right-wing Japanese pressure to say, yes, we'll join you in a military alliance. And if you go to war, we will go to war with you. Japan didn't do that until they never did that. In fact, they resisted that. And yet they were close, and Japan wanted to use Germany because Germany was going to make it easy to take the Asian colonies of the European powers, Germany, because Germany had conquered them. So the colonies of France, the Netherlands, and Britain looked like easy pickings for Japan. That was good. And Germany wanted to use Japan to help in its war. They kept pressuring Japan, bomb, invade Hong Kong. You know, you need to invade Malaysia. You need to go in and help us to relieve pressure on us. And then they lied. They deceived, I guess you could say. There were some, Germany and Japan had signed the Anti-Comintern Pact, which was a pact against communism. Japan hated communism because the communists had overthrown a czar and, you know, this imperial ruler. So they didn't want any communists coming into Japan to touch their divine emperor. And they thought that they had a commonality of against the USSR. And then Germany made a pact with the USSR, which allowed them to invade Poland and start the war. And that just shocked Japan. And then they didn't tell Japan they were going to invade Russia. Germany, of course, betrayed Russia, invaded Russia. And that shocked the Japanese. And then they didn't know what to do. Should we invade Russia, Japan's old enemy, and help Germany? Or should we continue our plans to move south and take over the rest of Southeast Asia? So there was it was all this complicated calculations on both parts. Japan did not tell Germany that they were going to bomb Pearl Harbor. You know, that was news to Germany. So they were allied, but their alliance was basically to overthrow the status quo, the democratic status quo of Europe and the United States.
So then that's what drew Japan to Germany as opposed to France or Britain or any of the Allied powers. These were democracies, and Japan was opposed to that.
Absolutely. That was one of the Western ideas that the right-wingers thought had polluted the Japanese way of life. It's so odd. You have this divine emperor and this parliamentary democracy. They're in total conflict with each other, those two ideas. And the militarists wanted to get rid of democracy and return to what they considered the good old days, make Japan great again, go back to our divine emperor when things were good.
Talk a little bit then about, so we're in like the late, so Germany has invaded Poland, World War II has started. What's Japan's attitude now for what they want their involvement to be, kind of leading up to Pearl Harbor in this 1 year, 2 year span of time? What are their ambitions?
Their ambitions are to take over Asia, to rule it, to control all of the resources of Asia, and to add to the Japanese empire. It's pretty simple. And this was even the moderates in Japan who wanted good relations with the West. They bought into that vision as well. They thought that the U.S. just stay on your side of the Pacific, we'll stay on our side of the Pacific, and everything will be fine. And of course, that was not acceptable to the United States or to the European powers.
So you write a little bit about Ambassador Gru and how he did not take. So about a year before Pearl Harbor, he passed on information to the State Department that Pearl Harbor could be targeted. Now he didn't take this seriously, and the State Department didn't seem to take it seriously either. Why do you think that was?
Well, because militarily it was a little bit preposterous to think that Japan, which is far, far away from Pearl Harbor, from Hawaii, that they would be able to mount an operation that we wouldn't detect. That's the first thing. It would be a very difficult thing to do. Second, why would they dare to attack us, the mighty United States, this little island kingdom? And they thought that the far more likely military targets would be the British colonies, the wealthy British colonies in Southeast Asia. So Hong Kong, especially. And so they discounted it. And so did our military. Our military considered it and thought it was very unlikely that it would be something else first, or that we would, even if they attempted it, we would detect it. And even if they attempted it, they couldn't possibly succeed because it would be too difficult to pull off. Of course, they had a genius who was designing that plan, Yamamoto, and it was possible. So we messed up. I mean, we misread it. Gru felt like everybody did warn it that towards the end of 1941, he said, I no longer have good contacts. They don't allow us to get to see what they're doing, but they are liable to attack the United States, and they're liable to do it suddenly and without warning, and don't discount that possibility. And Hornbeck, Hull's major advisor on the Far East, ridiculed that idea for months before Pearl Harbor because he didn't believe it could happen. On the other hand, Gru kept telling the Japanese, if you don't stop this, what you're doing, the United States will throw off this sheepskin and become a lion. And you have no chance. You have no chance against that line, and you must know that, because we're far bigger, we have far more resources, and you can't win. The Japanese discounted that. They thought that that America was too isolationist, that the public would not allow FDR to go to war. So he was talking in both directions, and neither side was believing what he had to say.
So why do you think then Japan ultimately decided on attacking Pearl Harbor as opposed to like the Philippines or some closer American target?
Well, they did attack them at the same time. Pearl Harbor was just one tine of the fork of that plan. They attacked Guam, they attacked Hong Kong, they attacked everything, you know, around the same time. Their idea was hit America hard, devastate the fleet, make frighten America, and they will come to the table and negotiate and give us what we want in Asia, and then we'll both go on our ways. Every time they did a war planning in Japan with the Navy, the Army, all the war planners said, we can last a year, maybe 2 years, and after that, we'll be overwhelmed. They knew they couldn't go into a long war. So they wanted to cripple the United States, scare them, get them to the negotiating table, and solve the issue that way. So, Americans aren't like that. I mean, that's not the way it's going to work.
Sure. So tell me then about, let's say, we'll do like a month before, a week before, and day of Pearl Harbor. Tell me about Ambassador Gru and what his immediate focus was.
He got more and more pessimistic about what was up ahead, but he kept looking for ways to get around that pessimism and find some kind of avenue. And he couldn't. So I'll tell you about the day of the Pearl Harbor attack, because that's pretty dramatic. The night before Pearl Harbor, FDR sent a telegram to Hirohito, a direct communication to the leader of Japan, saying, we need to stop what seems to be about to occur. We are the two leaders of our country. We can stop this. Let's do it. Because war makes no sense for either of our countries. The Army Telegraph Office held that telegram for 10 hours before Gru got it. It didn't make any difference at that point, because the Japanese ships and planes they'd already gotten their orders. But anyway, at midnight, Gru took that telegram over to the palace, the foreign minister, and said, I need to deliver this to the emperor as soon as possible tomorrow morning. Can you arrange it? And the foreign minister knew that the planes were on their way, but he said, yes, I will arrange that. So the next morning, Gru got up and he had an urgent message from the foreign minister, come see me right away. And he thought, well, that was quick work. I guess he's figured out, got me an appointment with the emperor. He went over there, and the foreign minister, whose name was Togo, handed him a document saying the negotiations are over. Thank you for your efforts. Nothing about war, nothing about that. Pearl Harbor had been hit hours before. So Gru went back and thought, well, we'll just have to start over. I'll figure something out. He put on his golfing clothes. He was going to play golf. He's about to leave, and he hears the newsboys out in the street calling the headlines, Japan bombs Pearl Harbor, declares war on the United States. That's how he found out about it.
That's incredible. I mean, it's on one hand, I guess this is a time before, the internet or, cell phones or whatever, but the fact that he was putting on golfing clothes while, ships were sinking in Pearl Harbor, is really incredible. Diplomatically, tell me about what, is there anything that could have been done differently on Ambassador Gru's end to prevent the bombing of Pearl Harbor?
Well, of course, that was the question he asked himself. He and the rest of the embassy staff were interned in the embassy for 9 months while negotiations occurred to try to free our diplomats and Japan's diplomats and make an exchange. And that's all he thought about for much of that 9 months. Is there anything I could have done? And he decided he had done everything he could. He had failed, but he had tried everything that he thought he could. And so he felt peaceful about that and terrible about the fact that he had failed. And it's the million-dollar question. I don't think anything really could have stopped Pearl Harbor, could have stopped the Japanese from doing what they did. It was too late. They were determined. They were so determined. They were so fanatical that they were immune to logic, to facts, to all the principles of diplomacy, mutual self-interest, cooperation, compromise, trust, keeping your word about anything. So when facts get replaced by paranoia, and Japan had a state media which gave them only the news that the leadership wanted them to have nothing from outside that. It was a one radio station. All the papers were controlled by this, by the state. So the Japanese people were fed a stream of lies, misinformation, paranoia, hatred, resentment. And that leads to myopia. It leads to fanaticism. It leads to a complete distortion of reality. And you can't conduct diplomacy under those conditions.
Now, what was Ambassador Gru? So there were several times before Pearl Harbor where he thought that conflict did flare up, but the sinking of the Panay, for example, he thought war was coming. How much of a surprise was the bombing of Pearl Harbor to Ambassador Gru, with him having lived in that kind of totalitarian, all-encompassing media environment? How much of a surprise was it to him?
Oh, I'm sure it was a surprise, because he never gave up hope that he would be able to avert it. But once it happened, he warned the U.S. government it could be coming. So it wasn't a total shock. It was just, he didn't know when it would happen. But he kept telling the government it will happen if we don't figure out a way to stop it somehow. So surprise, because it's always a surprise when somebody hits you in the face, even if they're they've got a boxing glove on, you know.
Sure. Now, so Pearl Harbor happens. Ambassador Gru eventually does find out. What then happens? Does he immediately leave the country? Where does he go from there?
They were interned for 9 months. The negotiations took place. They had a rougher deal than the Japanese diplomats, who were interned in a country club, a resort in West Virginia. Our embassy people stayed there. There was heat, was only on several hours a day. They had enough food, but not an abundance of food. They were treated poorly by the Japanese police who were guarding them. So they made the best of it. And after 9 months, the negotiations were complete. They got on a ship in June and started the trip. They started the trip to the United States. The Japanese got on a ship in the United States, and they met in Mozambique, what is now Mozambique. And the passengers on each ship got off and walked to the other ship, and got on that ship. And that's how the exchange was made.
So professionally, and then also professionally, what impact did Pearl Harbor have on Ambassador Gru's reputation as a diplomat? And then also, what impact personally did the attack have on him?
So it's a good question. I think when he came back, Secretary Hull sent him on a barnstorming tour around the country, 250 speeches in the first year, to talk about Japan and what Japan was like and what this regime was like. And of course, everybody wanted to hear what Gru had to say, because he was more familiar with the Japanese than just about any other American. And he told them that, first of all, don't get cocky, because they're a small country. He said they're unbelievably tough. Second, this military cult has to be rooted out and destroyed, or Japan will never return to the civilized nations. And third, please try to keep in mind that not everyone in Japan wanted this war, that some people did not want it, that there are a lot of good people in Japan, people that he said, I love. That part of the speech eventually got cut at the request of the War Office, for obvious reasons. It didn't fit in with the propaganda. And then after that, he became head of the foreign desk, the Asia desk, rather, in the State Department. Then he became Undersecretary of State, and he served as acting Secretary of State for often during the last year and a half or so of the war. He was involved in helping to define the terms for the Potsdam meeting, where the terms for surrender were discussed with Churchill, Truman, and Stalin and Chiang Kai-shek. Gru recommended and that the emperor be allowed to survive, if not Hirohito, at least the emperor as a concept, as a position in Japan, because he said, if you don't ensure that will continue, they'll never surrender. Somehow between, well, what happened is that Alamogordo, New Mexico happened. We dropped the test bombs and it became clear that we were not going to have to invade Japan. So the provision about letting the emperorship survive got cut out of the Potsdam terms. And consequently, the Japanese refused to surrender. So we dropped the bomb, we dropped another bomb. And finally, they said, the emperor said, we'll surrender, but the emperorship has to continue. And Gru was involved in convincing, perhaps, the Secretary of State and Secretary of War, who were making the final terms. He made it vague enough, they made it vague enough, so that the Japanese believed that the emperor would be allowed to remain somehow. And that's when they surrendered.
So then, personally, he never felt like a failure then. He, not only did he feel like he did the best that he could do, but after Pearl Harbor, he continued to bring the war, maybe not to a close, but he continued to have an impact within the State Department for the war. Is that fair?
He was a patriot. And so he absolutely wanted to crush the Japanese military. But he also, as he said, it was his favorite post, his favorite country. He loved the Japanese and the Japanese culture. So it was difficult. He was trying to do two things: get rid of these fanatics, and also remind Americans they can be our friends again. Let's keep that in mind. There are good people there. And he never returned to Japan, which I think is pretty telling, because the war ended in 1945. He didn't die until the 65. And so he could have gone back, and he didn't. And he in one letter, he wrote, I didn't want to face my old friends as a conqueror, which I think is an interesting point.
Well, kind of my last question here, Steve, what lessons do you think diplomats have to learn from Gru?
Well, I suppose one is never succumb to the idea that war is inevitable. Keep working. Be empathetic to the country where you're posted, despite what appears to be many reasons why you should not be, because otherwise you won't make any progress. And third, keep in mind that no matter what you try to do, you still may fail if you run up against fanaticism, lies, misinformation, deceit. So diplomacy can only go so far. Gru knew that. He called it our first line of defense. But it can't solve everything. It's helpless against certain forms of totalitarian thinking.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for talking to me. Again, loved your book. Everybody, Our Man in Tokyo is the name of the book. Please go out. If you're like me, go to multiple libraries to find it, order it, buy it. It's really I think for one of the reasons that you said, Steve, Americans just don't know so much about the lead up to Pearl Harbor in Japan. It was so fascinating to me to just learn about that. So,
me too.
Yeah. Wonderful. Well, Steve, where can people find you? Are you on social media? Where can people get in touch or check out your work?
I have a website. It's www.stevekemper.net. And there's information on there about the book and my other books. And there's other podcasts that I've done. People aren't sick of my voice at this point. They could hear more of it there. I'm not on social media. So
okay. Good for you.
Yeah.
Wonderful. All right. Well, thank you everybody for listening, and take care.
Thanks.